Okay, right back with you. Clifford Garnick on the show tonight. Part two of our conversation, part one, can be heard in the archives last Monday evening. His website, carnicom.com, invaluable to understanding what's being done to our atmosphere by those who would seek to change it for their own gains. And there are some, and they are doing it, and have been doing it for years. Clifford is in the middle of a very important conversation. Hopefully you've been listening. If not, tune in and listen up, because we're going to continue now and watch where this goes. We talked about the atmosphere, the ionosphere, the lower atmosphere. Now we're going to talk about the soil and increased conductivity, much higher than Clifford expected to find. Go ahead.
Thank you, Jeff. Four more comments on this article on the salt study of the soil salts levels and concentration levels that I did. The first is why is it important? Well, simply if a salt, increased salt increases stress on plants. That's what it's about. So we're not able to get away with just thinking about the air as this issue has proceeded over the years. And it's time that we do think in a much more comprehensive sense, rather than people debating whether airplanes are doing funny things in the sky.
Well, this is the logical extension of the discussion about the dangers and damages of acid rain.
It is, and my work, it's never simply gone there before, but this is a brief entry that I've made into these fields that you really do at some point need to consider the complete total environmental impact of what we're talking about. And if plants are, and I'm not claiming that it's true, but I am raising the issue. I am saying that the studies indicate that there may indeed be increased salt levels in the soils. Maybe the data I have is indicating that, and that it may come, if that's the case, it may come from deposition through atmospheric processes as well as water processes, accumulation of rain, and that type of thing. So more plants will die, and then you could extend that argument to say that our food base would eventually likely be affected if indeed it were an accumulating problem over time. The second would be that of an observation, and that is in these conductivity tests that I'm making of the soil, there is a very strong, what appears to be what I would call a leaching effect. In other words, these soils are being put in solution and they're being measured over time.
Mm-hmm.
I've done some research on how these soil tests are conducted. And in all the cases that I can read about, it appears as though your conductivity measurements are generally fairly stable when you take the test, and they're not supposed to have major changes. The one site that I did find referencing major changes regarded it as highly significant and stated that the soil sample should be sent for more comprehensive testing as to what was causing that change.
So there was great concern there.
Pardon me?
There was concern there.
Yes, absolutely, yes. Uh-huh. It was not considered as a normal affair to have changes in these conductivity levels on any dramatic level over time. In my work, these changes are dramatic in my environment. There is another individual who is doing some work on the Oregon coast, and his work right now, his initial work, does not look like it's as dramatic as what I'm seeing here. But, I'm in an arid environment, so any kind of rainfall can potentially have a very big effect on the chemistry of the soil.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a dramatic effect in terms of the change on conductivity, and it increases dramatically over time, but fairly slowly. It takes me roughly anywhere from 4 to 7 days for the results to stabilize, whereas normally, like this person that made this reference to change, they said after 12 to 24 hours, if you get a change, you better be doing some more sophisticated work. So I get significant changes over a 4 to 7 day period where it finally will stabilize and maximize out. And the best interpretation that I can make of this is that there appears to be a leaching effect that's taking place. In other words, there are ions that are being released into the solution slowly over time. It is not inconceivable to me that that is consistent, with let's say a salt, that is in the process of dissolving and becoming in solution. So, that's an observation that's there. The second, third comment here would be that in part, not entirely, but in part, this work has also been motivated by and supported by observations in my local area. And it involves two environmental habitats. The first is a grassland. I'm in a location where there's a large grassland area that I have watched over the last 5 to 6 years now. And there's been a curious change that has taken place in this grassland over the past 5 to 6 years. And that is, 5 to 6 years ago, this land was fully capable of providing significant feed to some livestock out here.
Right.
I'm not saying it's highly productive land. That would be very unrealistic. It's a very arid environment. But the fact is, in fact, if you look at the history of this country and what's going on, you know, there's huge cattle ranches out here in the high deserts of New Mexico. One of the largest cattle ranches I've ever seen in my entire life is due south of me. The thing is 30 miles long without a power line or house along it.
Hmm.
So the basis for livestock is here in this land, and it was here when I first started watching this 5 to 6 years ago. I have noticed over the last 5 to 6 years a continual deterioration of this grassland, to the point where it is completely unusable now, and it's not a case of overgrazing. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm only talking about a couple of animals on a large tract of land. But the nature of the vegetation has simply changed, and it is simply not grass. And it's, you know, it's turned into a weed environment. But the fascinating thing now is that even if you get rain, this last, you know, we had a drought for several years, but this last spring, we had record rainfalls. We had a huge season of rainfall this spring. The interesting observation is that even when you get profound levels of rain, even under the most optimum conditions of germination and growth, there is no grass in this area.
You'd think it would come back.
I'm not trying to overextend the argument. I'm just saying this is an observation which is at least consistent with a gradual but slow change in the environment. And it may be when coupled with this work on conductivity, at least an avenue for investigation. I think that's fair. The second observation has to do with a major die-off that has happened in the Santa Fe area over the last 2 to 3 years, and it involves pinyon pine species. And this die-off, it's just tremendous. It's really sad when you see it. I've seen this thing now over at least a 40-mile area. It just involves millions of acres. And the pinyon pine has just died. You have massive die-offs, and there's photographs of this on my site. I am not trying to contradict conventional and understandable explanations for what may have happened. I would say that is characterized in the common community as being a result of the drought. You know, we had an extreme drought for 5 years, and the common wisdom is that the pinyon pine was put under stress by these drought conditions and eventually done in by a beetle here. What I am doing is simply opening up the avenue of investigation a little bit further and asking the question whether or not there may be a stress factor that results from increased saline or salt stress. And it does not appear to be out of range to consider this proposition in light of the tests I have done. And a rather fascinating finding, also unexpected, was the rather dramatic increase in conductivity as you got closer to the trunk or the root of these pinyon pines. It took me a while to see that pattern was there. I was trying to explain some variation that I had. But there is this pattern that shows up of proximity to the tree itself is very important in the results. Now, this gets a little bit difficult to interpret. I'm not going to claim to be a soil scientist, but, you know, it was very hard to find any papers referencing this phenomenon of variation of conductivity with respect to proximity to the tree. But the one or two papers that I did find explained that variation primarily in terms of calcium and magnesium salts. And lo and behold, that becomes a little bit interesting when you find that this initial work that we're starting with again comes back to magnesium and calcium as being two of the elemental forms that are showing up from the atmospheric level on down.
Did the paper or papers you were able to consult and find discuss origin of the magnesium?
I'm sorry, Deb, I heard you make a reference to the paper, and then what are you asking about the paper?
Did they discuss the origin of the increased conductivity, the magnesium, et cetera, that was...
No, they were simply, they ran a test where they were trying to determine if there was variation in conductivity as a function of distance. Not many people are doing this at all, from what I can find. It seems to be really hard to come by.
All right.
And the one person that was trying to explain this, these references are cited on my paper here as to who they are. But the guy that did this work simply came to the conclusion, what did he say? The second paper does not refer to variation with... at two different parts, right. The second paper does not refer to variation with respect to distance, but does explain the majority of conductivity variation from calcium-magnesium ions. So that guy simply was looking for a variation. And he ascribed it to calcium and magnesium salt forms. The other guy came up with distance, but he didn't have a reason, okay?
Okay.
So it's a little bit, the research on this was certainly not real easy for me to come by, and it doesn't seem like it's a common topic.
Well, we have to pause here. Hold on. Hopefully you'll be able to submit a paper to some of these journals. Maybe one will even publish it. Wow, fascinating. All right, more to come with Clifford Carnicom in just a minute. Back with Clifford Carnicom, we're talking about the atmosphere and the soil. Of course, they are inextricably linked together. One follows the other. Acid rain, think about that, but think about rain as it impacts the aerosol spraying operations over so many countries now in the Western world, Australia to Europe, the U.S., of course. All that stuff up there, the barium and the other issues, are going somewhere, and they're going into the ground. And we're seeing, according to the research by Clifford Carnicom, clear and unmistakable changes, degradations in the environment that are no doubt linked to what's going on in the skies above us. Go ahead, Clifford.
Thank you again, Jeff. The last comment on this soil paper is more of a predictive nature, and I'll just have to generalize it, but I would say it this way, and that is that I have some concern based on the results that I see in my local area that this die-off, this pinyon pine die-off, which is just massive in scope, it's feasible to me that that type of die-off may extend to a broader region and especially a higher elevation here. And probably the next most dominant species up here, at least at altitude, will be the ponderosa pine.
Uh-huh.
And if we ever get to the point where this increases in elevation and hits the ponderosa pine, it's already affected, but
the whole ecosystem will collapse.
Just be a disaster here.
Yeah.
And the work that I'm doing says to me that this is not inconceivable at all. And in fact, I would issue a warning that over the upcoming years, we should be looking for continued degradation to the point where it may be literally catastrophic in terms of
the
basis of that ecosystem.
Not good news. Not at all.
So that's my final comment on the salt, and I see we're only at number 6 on our list out of 13.
All right, we better shift into third gear here.
Yeah, but I think we'll do all right here. Let's see what we can do. Now to a completely... separate topic, or what may appear to be, but in the end, all of these topics will loop together. Next topic is that of ELF measurement. Again, about 4 years ago, I did quite a bit of work on the detection of whether or not there was ELF energy in our, what I call, ambient environment, our continuous surrounding world. And that work provided very strong evidence that indeed that this was the case, and that there is the presence of ELF propagation, extremely low frequency propagation, unexpected and by all accounts artificial, not related to the power grid structure. And the conclusion of that work stated that measurements at multiples of 4 hertz were repeatedly being detected and suggested that 4 hertz may be a fundamental frequency in terms of what's going on here.
Hmm.
Now, the reason that work is important, because if it's true, Mm-hmm. You're talking about electromagnetic energy that is operating at the same frequencies and wavelengths of the human body and the human mind. And so, again, it is profound in terms of its potential implications if this is verified.
Well, Dr. Bob Beck did a lot of work with 4 hertz.
Pardon me, Jeff?
Dr. Bob Beck did a lot of work with 4 hertz. I think it was 4.1.
Yes, in fact, I'll be referring to...
Yeah.
Well, right, you're referring to Beck, and there's also a Becker who I'll be referring to.
Yeah, well, Beck...
You probably
Beck
know
is,
them both.
Yes,
that's interesting
on
Beck and his work. I have to look into that.
Yeah.
That work was issued and stated for what it is. Now, what's happened here is that about 3 years have passed, and I have revisited that issue because there are certain circles that keep forming and forming, but as the data becomes more and more solid over years and time passes, that is what solidifies any hypothesis that is made. And I wanted to revisit this ELF question because I was very curious about the passage of time. First of all, I wanted to eliminate in my mind any doubt whether or not what I was measuring could have been a fluke or something that might be a result of my local environment, that type of thing.
Right.
And it's just a matter of assurance as to whether or not this phenomenon was real. And the passage of 3 years was very significant to revisit it. So I did that. And this time, from past experience, you can improve upon your methods. And the result of the work is this, and that is that I would positively state, this is not a maybe on this one, I would positively state that the measurement of ELF energy at 4 hertz multiples has now been established as positively as I can, at least, as an individual, now by 3 completely different methods. And that's the part where the work becomes stronger. I now have 3 completely different methods of determining whether or not this energy is there. The first is in what would be called the time domain, where you're simply looking at the recording of frequencies over time. The second would be in a spectral domain, where you're looking at a frequency analysis approach. And the third is with the development of a resonant circuit, principles of resonant circuitry. And they're all very different, and they all say the same thing. And this time, it is just as definite as can be. Now, 3 years have elapsed, and this is telling us that this is not a fluke from what I see. This is real. It has now been in effect for well over 3 to 4 years that I have been measuring. There's no reason to think that there would be a gap in between. I cannot come up with any natural explanation for this radiation. Your power grid system is at 60 hertz. You don't go having fundamentals of 4 hertz in any light fashion. Many of us are familiar with the Schumann frequency of roughly 8 hertz. It's actually fascinating when you think of this because you are the Schumann frequency results from essentially the nature and size of the Earth itself.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a beam of light and send it around the Earth, it will correspond to the Schumann frequency in terms of wavelength and such.
Right, right. We have here's a break coming up again. The Schumann frequency or Schumann resonance was 7.83. Now it's up to just over 8, I think, Clifford.
That's right.
Increased.
There has been some change in it, and people have overstated that change. I'm glad that you have stated it as it is. It's a percentage change, but not at all what some
very
people
small.
Are claiming.
Right.
It is
some
roughly
people
8
saying,
hertz, and that's because it's defined by the physical Earth.
Right, exactly. Some people are saying 10, but no, not the case. Back in just a minute with Clifford Carnicombe. All right, back with Clifford Carnicombe, ELF in multiples of 4 hertz. Interesting. 4 hertz, 8 hertz. 8 hertz, of course, the Earth's own natural resonant frequency emission output, aura, whatever you want to call it, called the Schumann resonance. And go ahead, Clifford. This is fascinating.
For anyone that is doubting the existence of this measurement, I would start by simply referring them to a graph that's on the webpage. I've accumulated many forms over the years, but it's fairly direct now, the methods that I have. Mm-hmm. And there is a paper there called ELF 2005 Positive Identification, and you'll see the spectral analysis graph there. And, you know, by the way, this type of energy is not real easy to measure. Yeah, you have problems. The 60 hertz signal pretty much tries to overwhelm anything. But as I've worked on the equipment over the years here and developed independent methods trying to verify the work, I have been able to isolate this with certainty here. And the graph is as clear as can be. You can see the peaks right at 4, 8, 12, 16, and 20.
Wow, this is amazing. I wish I knew the name of the... doggone it, the frequency that was found embedded into the power grid that shouldn't be there. This is fascinating. Let's see.
So the evidence is rather compelling, I would say, at this point for the existence of this radiation. Now, one of the things that's fascinating here from a physical standpoint is that you are dealing with a wavelength here that's longer than the Earth itself, okay, by a factor of two. And so it raises many interesting geophysical questions. I mean, certainly one can generate a frequency at any level you want. That's part of the resonant technique I use, and I can generate a frequency of 1 hertz as far as that goes. But the question is power, amount of energy, and how far is that signal going to be detected? And the energy that I'm talking about here, everything, I won't go into it in great depth, but everything here says that this energy is propagating along the magnetic field lines of the Earth and that we're dealing with a global phenomenon here.
Propagating, but can we speculate as to source?
Well, yes, absolutely. It would be, to me, completely consistent with the HARP technology in terms of that's exactly how that energy does propagate along the magnetic field lines of the Earth.
So they pump it up, but it comes right back down and somehow finds its way into the Earth's own magnetic ley lines?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, you know, HARP is located at its point because it's quite an education to read that patent, I'll tell you. It really does.
And I'll bet the more you read it, the more you understand.
The location of that is not an accident. It has to do with a conduit into the magnetic field of the Earth.
Oh, basically, very good.
Yeah, it has a pathway right into the polar structure, and so that energy can feed up right into the magnetic field.
Oh, they've taken Tesla way down the road, haven't they?
Right. So I'm going to go on because, you know, I'm going to try to work my time here. So the existence of this radiation is real from the best, certainly, that I can ascertain.
Okay.
Now it gets a little bit interesting also because we have to explain another phenomenon. And I had read about this several years ago. In fact, I'd done some initial work. I'd done a lot of initial work on a lot of the subjects that we're talking about. It's just that there's a level of confirmation that's being established with this recent round of research that I think is, let's say, rather convincing that there is a case for physical mechanisms that we're describing here.
Right.
There is a phenomenon called cyclotronic resonance. It is this, and that is that if you have a charged particle, and remember, an ion is a charged particle. If you have a charged particle in the presence of a magnetic field, and that particle is moving, it will resonate at a certain frequency. It'll actually travel around a magnetic field line. I don't know if people can imagine magnetic field lines, but that's what it is. It's a field. And so if you imagine a magnetic field line, a charged particle will rotate, revolve around that magnetic field line. And depending on the orientation of the orbit and all this kind of stuff, the most common form would be that of a helix. You'd have a spiral going on. This electron would do it, and a charged particle would do it also. And so this phenomenon is called cyclotronic resonance. And it depends on three things. Of those three, one of them is going to be very important. They're all important, but one's especially important. It depends upon the charge of that particle. It depends upon the mass of that particle. But especially interesting, it depends upon the magnetic field strength that it's in. So if the magnetic field strength changes, then this frequency can change. And they call this cyclotronic resonance, and I'd refer people to Robert Becker's book called Cross Currents.
Classic.
And he has a nice little section on this where he starts talking about this, and I have a short quote in there about the concern of his, and that is that cyclotronic resonance has the potential affecting very important biological ions.
Right.
In our body,
right.
if we were to encounter such a situation. Now, here's where it gets interesting. And remember, the Earth's magnetic field is a part of what makes this happen. Here's where it gets interesting. If you compute all of the resonant frequencies of all of the elements in their common ion form, common forms, for the whole periodic table, which is what I've done, I basically had to write a program to do it because there's many combinations.
Hmm.
If you go through the whole periodic table looking for particular combinations of elements and resonant frequencies, you come up with something extremely interesting. And that is that there is one element that resonates at a frequency which is in exact which is an exact match to the harmonics of this ELF energy that I'm talking about. Let's back up on this one a little bit. The specifics are that the cyclotronic resonant frequency of the potassium ion in the presence of the Earth's magnetic field is 20 hertz, almost exactly. 19.8, and it varies a little bit on the magnetic field. Also keep in mind, the magnetic field is a factor here, so as you get towards the poles, that would change a little bit, or as the equator. But in the mid-latitude regions of the Earth, the resonant frequency of the potassium ion will be 20 hertz.
That sounds like 5 times 4 to me.
That's right, that's right. Now, this is not easy to come by, folks. In other words, you do not find many combinations. I went through the whole periodic table. I have about 3 to 4 that are of interest.
Huh.
But this potassium is sticking out because 20 hertz, as you have just remarked, is the exact multiple of this fundamental of 4 hertz that's showing up. And, in fact, I have one graph there. We're now at a paper that would lead to the title of this paper is Potassium Interference is Expected. And if folks look at that paper, you will see where I have isolated the 20 hertz signal that is measured on the ground, and how prominent that peak is. It's very, very definite. Now, if you then learn that the frequency that is resonant in our bodies with that measured frequency is a potassium ion, it now starts to raise some concern and questions. And I'm not even making any inference here of intent or not. Right. I am simply saying this is a fact.
The chances for this happening in a random fashion are astronomical.
I won't even need to say that because one can go on from that because we have a condition that exists.
Right.
You particular ion in the human body that is extremely important. I've heard some papers that say potassium is the most important.
Stand by, it's going to be in the top
3 or 4 without any question.
Okay, hold on right there, Clifford. Be right back in just a minute. I'm talking about ELF, EMF. Reminds me, of course, not only of HARP, which we've been talking about tonight, and this is all tying together, but 1976, Clifford, the start of the Russian over-the-horizon radar, the electromagnetic attack on the United States, known as the Woodpecker, July 1976. This is all fascinating, and it's all recorded. And go ahead. I want to see where this goes.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. The reason this is important is because if you have a condition of resonance that is to take place, though the ion in the body would absorb energy. I mean, this is what the effect of it would be. Certainly, my predicted effect. I'm not claiming a plot here. I'm claiming an observable measurement coupled with a fundamental physical phenomenon that is known in classic electromagnetic theory, that this combination leads to a prediction, if certainly not an expectation, that the potassium ion in the human body is very likely to be interfered with because that ion will absorb energy.
Right.
And you therefore are now pulling yourself away from the natural exchange, ionic exchange processes in the human cell functions. So it certainly, I think, raises a very legitimate and strong concern. And then furthermore, if you now start broadening your discussion beyond potassium, it is found, at least in my research, that the interplay between calcium and potassium and magnesium in the body is very important. In other words, if a person were to have a potassium deficiency, you may also experience complications with magnesium. And I have read the same coupling with the magnesium and the calcium ions. So this discussion is not limited in terms of its potential complications and interference with human cellular processes, and not just human necessarily, by the way, by any means, but to now fully encompass the consideration of the primary, all of the primary electrolytes in the human body. And, you know, that's how I would phrase this, is that I would say there is a legitimate basis for concern and examination of fundamental electrolytic imbalances amongst the human body, and that there are physical symptoms of ionic imbalance that are very interesting. And you know, when you and I talked last time about the health symptoms of ionic imbalance,
right?
Well, again, we have a very strong tie-in, at least in terms of further investigation and research,
right,
as to why we may be seeing specific health symptoms appearing. And so I'm not claiming to be any doctor, and you'll see my statements very carefully on my paper, that I'm not offering any medical advice, but I would say that there is a basis for examining the primary electrolytic levels and concentrations in our bodies, and to understand the implications of any imbalances within them. There is a very
As caused by external EMF.
Yes, right. The reason that this paper came up is because of the ELF detection. In other words, that is an external source of energy, unaccounted for at this point, that
could
appears
making,
completely artificial.
Could be making the entire human species less well all the time.
Well, these are the questions that certainly arise.
Right.
And there is a paradox here that arises to me, and I think we're going to make it just fine through here. I'll get through these other two papers.
Sure, we've got about 6 minutes.
Okay. The paradox here is that there's a case for examining deficiencies or disturbances of the body with primary electrolytes. The paradox is that what is being placed into the atmosphere appears to be the very same components. So it means that we may be dealing with very complicated, you know, chemical interactions here, and their combinations with energy, with respect to an original source and its eventual mutated or transformed form within our body, or eventual deficiency or excess, either way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one that's certainly going to require some more work. I'm going on to the last because I do know we're getting short. The last two topics I have, the first will be the first reports that I'm aware of that are reporting on the actual ion concentration in our atmosphere. That kind of data is not real easy to come by. It's pretty much about as direct measure of conductivity as you can get. I'll say this in a somewhat tantalizing form. I'm not intending to just sort of bait people, but in my research, it appears as though direct ion information in the lower atmosphere is not readily available.
Uh-huh.
It may even be considered as a security issue.
National security.
I have made my statement on my paper that I believe that the public has the right for a monitoring of the environmental condition of our planet, and I am asserting that right with the measurement of this data, and I believe that it is a very important avenue of investigation that should be opened up to the general public, and that I hope that that is done beyond what I am able to do. And if there is any disturbance or interference at all with the flow of data regarding ionic research of the lower atmosphere and making that data publicly available, then I would say that we need a whole stack of people in line right behind what I'm doing to continue.
I agree.
The last statement is, the last paper is actually quite significant, and it has to do with the determination of the conditions under which the operations are actually taking place. This is a paper called Ions and Humidity. It would appear to me, based on this work, that the environmental conditions that are favorable to the conduct of the operations may have now been determined with a very high degree of reliability. The actual conditions appear to be what would be described as a local minimum of relative humidity and combined with a low negative ion count. There is a graph on this paper that shows a track record of when the operations are occurring. It took a lot of work to collect this data over the last 2 months. There's a graph that shows when these operations are occurring relative to humidity levels and ion counts, and there's a very, very strong pattern that is appearing. It appears to be quite definite.
Talking
and what's interesting here is there's always been something known about moisture, but it looks like it's even more definite than that, and it's a complete lie about these operations being conducted under terms of high humidity. The actual points, commencement of operations appears to be taking place at point, local points, what you'd call it. Could be lower and, I mean, higher on either side of it, but local minimums of relative humidity and negative ion count.
Talking about aerosol spraying, that's what we're talking about.
So, you know, that's a paper that I'll lead people as a lead on to.
Now, these are all at carnicom.com. Direct people where they can find the papers. And again, there are a lot of people listening right now taking notes and recording to find out how much you know and how much we know about what they are up to. Fascinating. Fascinating thing to consider. Where on your site can they find these papers?
Oh, they're all near the headlines. You know, I'm changing my site there a little bit, but on the main site, if they hit about any button they have, they'll see bring them to a page with a series of articles, and these are at the top of that list. Here's the title: things like calcium and potassium, laboratory services terminated, conductivity, soil salts of our soils, ELF 2005. What's potassium interference expected? Ion status report, ions and humidity. These type of titles you'll see.
I am, Clifford, I've said it before, I stand stunned at the amount of work you have done, at the accomplishments that you have achieved on our behalf, because you're a patriot, but more than that, you're a citizen of the planet. And we're trying to find out what they are doing, and what they are doing is not in our best interests. Not the least of which is the factor that continually pops up that they won't tell us anything about it. And we do have a right to know, as you've said.
We do, and I'll just always do the best I can, and hopefully we can all act as citizens of this planet. I know there's many of us that are care and have a voice that is just waiting to be heard.
We have a minute and a half left, so go ahead and wrap it up any way you'd like. As we look up to the skies and we see no longer blue skies like we used to in many, many parts of the country and around the world as well.
Yeah, I would just say in general, no, this was a burst of research that came about in a very somewhat unexpected way.
Because of that paper.
A single lab test. Yeah, it's a real burst. I have about 9 papers I've written. I should write about 4 to 5 more. I'm just not sure if I'll make it. And it shows what, with just a little bit of hard data, what can be accomplished. And it shows a tremendous need that exists for involvement of citizens of the planet, to take their role, of confronting the forces which have attempted to assert themselves and dominate themselves, over the human race when there is no claim to do so. It is, as you say, our birthright, our planet. And if it is our time to assert that.
We must also keep in mind that whatever they let leak out in the mainstream media is ancient history to many of them. They're way, way ahead of what they let us on to.
Right. All that I can do is simply give a direction as to where I think we should be going.
Right. Right. Well, Clifford, again, it has been extraordinary. Your burst of creativity and investigation and research and writing. Keep me posted on the other papers that are to come. Take your time. Just don't burn yourself out. I don't know how you do it. It just always amazes me.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people listening who I'm sure would shake your hand and say thank you right now if they could.
Jeff, I thank you very much for all that you're doing, and I really appreciate you have always been very open and one of the few people to allow a complete and open forum on this topic from the very beginning.
Well, it's my pleasure, my friend. You're doing the work. I'm happy to help.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeff, for everything.
Okay. All right, Clifford. Good night.
Yeah. Bye-bye now.
Clifford Carnicom, one of the truly great scientists of our time, if you think about it. He's a citizen scientist. And what he's doing is truly extraordinary. Carnicom.com, CARNICOM.com. And for all of those out there who are listening who know about this stuff, you know who you are. He's one tough hombre. I think you'll have to concede him that at least. All right, we'll be back in 21 hours.